Welcome to Brick Talk Live, a podcast about the restoration of brick buildings and historic town centres and the science behind it. Fellow Brit Alan Pettingale talks to key people in the industry about improvements in methods of restoration, as well as the concerns and issues that come with such projects. Today, we're going to be talking about Bricktie Services and Brian Hindle, the CEO who established the company with his father. Al, would you call yourself an expert in masonry restoration?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. A few people have asked me that in the past, and I'd rather say I was a professional in that I'm opening to learning every single day because, to be honest, I don't know everything. So, no, I'm a professional and I like learning. I've met a lot of experts who say that they're an expert and yet that sometimes they're not. So, no, I'm a professional. I like to keep learning and trying. Keep me an open mind on the subject.
That sounds like a much better way. So how did you get started in this?
Oh, in wall ties and anchoring with Brian Hindle? Ah, that was really, really cool, really. I've been in the military. I enjoyed it, travelled around, really enjoyed the military, but I realised it wasn't for me, so I decided I needed to get out. And when I got out, I still didn't know what I wanted to be. So I did all kinds of different jobs as young lads do. And one day, a friend of mine said to me, "Hey, look at this in this magazine." And it was an article on stabilizing walls using wall ties, a new system. And there were a company in Leeds and they were called Bricktie Services. And it was run by a guy called Brian Hindle. So anyway, going backwards and forwards on the phone, I'd arranged to meet him and his father to talk about working with them. I went up to Leeds and met with Brian Hindle and his father. Lovely people, lovely people. They'd already been in the game for many, many years. His father was something of an exception in the fact that he was into damp proofing, Yorkshire damp. And he actually only had one leg. And he'd go under the floors and do surveys on the buildings. He was such an amazing man. And he always had, one thing I always remembered about him, he was always an elegant, proud man. And his wife was as well. Amazing couple. So then we started talking about how they got into the wall ties, working with engineers. And they were right at the pinnacle, right at the forefront of it. When Bricktie Services first did the wall ties, they were working with an engineer, and before then there really wasn't any metal detectors to locate the ties in the wall. So they come up with an idea of taking a brick out, looking inside with a flashlight and a mirror to see if they could see the ties in there, where they could, so they could pull one out and put one back in. This was before there was a lot of standards and things, but an engineered design system to stabilize the wall. As time went on, they changed. But anyway, let me get back into it. So I'd approach them to work with them, and I did. And I covered up around my area of Yorkshire, out towards my hometown of Hull and around the area. Thing is, a lot of the area that I lived in was old, solid buildings, so there wasn't a lot of cavities to repair. So I used to travel a bit, and we'd work on different jobs all over the place. And one thing about Bricktie Services is that when I got involved with them, they did explain to me that there would be a training involved.
Smart. And
that was cool. And what type of training? Well, because we install wall ties, you had to learn about all the different wall ties, how they worked in different substrates. Would it be block? Would it be brick? What to look for, problems of how to install different ties, because on the market in then there was about 20 different ties, with a lot of manufacturers saying that one tie repairs everything, and it didn't. The actual truth is, it's the right tie for the right job, and actually the right man that's been trained to install that tie to do the right job. So there's a twofold combination of that there, definitely. Yeah, I got involved with it. And one of the things that I enjoyed about it was that when we went to go and investigate buildings, Brian had put together a training manual of what to look for, how to look for. different problems. So we had a training, in-house training manual, and this was always been updated because we were adding to it. After each job, we always debriefed, said what we found, what we didn't find. It was a bit like the military, but index what info, debrief. And it really worked because it helped us to share knowledge with the other teams in Bricktie that were working together to make us all better. And also, as well, Brian Hindle understood that it was very important to teach the guys because you only got one shot at it. And a lot of the times, the work we're doing, some of it could be a dangerous situation. So in them dangerous situations, Brian Hindle wanted us to have it appraised, working with engineers and architects to make sure that the whole team was safe while doing this. Because we did work on bigger structures, such as apartment complexes, as it's in America. We worked on lots of housing estates. We worked on high rises, commercials, churches, bridges, all kinds of things. And all these structures needed to be appraised differently. And also, as well, once they've been appraised, come up with a repair strategy. And that's where Bricktie and Brian Hindle and himself was really good at that. So yeah, I think that this was the beginning of where I started to learn it. But also, as well, that's just the basics, because as we progressed in Bricktie, Brian Hindle understood that to accomplish structural repairs, we needed different systems that could take it on to stabilize these buildings. And it wasn't with high-tech modern equipment just. We used old-style technologies as well, of straps and back straps and things like this. So to be aware and make aware of these situations, the managers at Brickties would set up presentations. So we'd get the local engineers, architects, surveyors, and people like that to come and have lunch. And we'd give them a seminar on how and why wall ties were falling into disrepair, what to look for, how to repair them, how we repair them. And also, as well, when we got into the bigger anchors, we started talking with a lot more engineers and architects on the structural problems, which was really good because that's where I started really getting into it. I really enjoyed the diamond coring because you had to do diamond coring to insert these anchors. You had to have a lot of training, a lot of knowledge. And it was always challenging because the thing is with historical buildings, as I've pointed out many, many times before, historic buildings and masonry under duress are one word. They're unpredictable. And in being unpredictable, you've got to keep eyes and ears from safety, from public, from the people that are in the building. You have to be aware of all of this. So the thing is that when people ask me about repairing masonry, it's not just a bit of mortar and you fill a crack. What we do and what we've started is been specialist technicians and specialists that are trained in a unique art form, you might call it. But it certainly resonated through England because all the years that have gone by with Brian Hindle, he has been a market leader. He's worked on old monuments such as the York Wall, even I've been involved with all that with him and different things. So to work on these old structures is amazing because then you learn the history and everything else. But then you've got to realize that you've got to be very, very precision and very delicate in trying to put this back together. It's almost surgical in approach. I think that's one way of putting it. I think that to become a restoration specialist, you're almost becoming like a surgeon. Let me try and put this a better way. When I'm teaching, a lot of times people ask me, how would you do it? I said, okay. And a lot of times I use the idea that cut to the chase. When we were younger, we all knew about Lego, be it your kids, be it yourself, be whatever. But if you take it into this context that you pick up the Lego and you put the flat base down and you build your little small house, you put your windows in it, you put your roof on it, a little chimney in it, all looks good. You can paint that in your head. But what we're going to do now is we're going to twist that base on the Lego. And when we twist the base on that Lego, it's going to cause a crack. So what we're going to do is we're going to come in, and what we're going to do is we're going to put a pin to hold that crack back together. There you go. That's the basic. But In reality, when you're dealing with buildings that are almost 50, 100 years, 200, 300, 1500, you have to have a different approach altogether. So skill set is plays an important part, and why I like what I do is that it took me a long time to get here, but it opened up a lot of facets of masonry restoration that nobody would ever think of, because we get to see on the inside of the building all the time when we're taking the buildings apart and putting them back together. We are your forensic team. And one thing I learned from Brian Ingle is that when we're over here in America, you talk about forensics, and I've got a very good friend who's a PhD, Nelson, a friend of mine that's into forensics over here. He is a market leader over here when it comes into doing this, because we've worked together for 25 years. But a lot of America certainly would learn from doing a lot more non-destructive and destructive testing, because you can appraise the situation for what it is and make calculated adjustments to make sure that it can be remediated. I think that's one way of putting it. I was lucky enough to learn, as I said, with Brian Hindle and all the specialists that were around, especially one thing that one bunch of group of people that I'd like to mention. I've mentioned the engineers and architects, but in England, when I was around the 90s, we have a group in England called the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors. And they've got to go to school for 5 years to be very good at what they do, inspecting buildings and surveying buildings. Their Americans would call them home inspectors, but of a much higher quality. These guys have been to college for 5 years to do what they do, and they are amazing what they do. So in the past, what they used to do was that they had to go inspect buildings for the lending societies, the banks and people and stuff like that. And what happened was that in England, you could barely buy a house without having the wall ties inspected. And that was a part of the mortgage. So what happened was that the chartered surveyor had come round your house and looked for any defects. And if he saw that there was any cracking horizontally or something that indicated that there could be a cavity wall type corrosion, what he'd do is he'd reach out to people like us and recommend that a survey be done to determine if it had cavity wall type corrosion or not, so that the bank could say the works need to be remediated or it's okay. And then they would lend the money to the actual customers. But they always give you a good report. So one of the things is that you do learn, especially when I was with Brian, that you had to learn how to read reports from engineers, surveyors, and also as well write reports, because when we found a problem, we had to put the reports forward. But again, Brian already had a training, a manual put into place. So we always had a draft that we started from, and then we could attach everything to it. Because in them days, this was before the internet, there really wasn't any pictures. The only pictures that you had was from a 35 millimeter camera, or you had the old Polaroid, which, to be honest, you didn't want to do too many of them because they cost a bloody fortune. And they were hard to stick to the report with a bit of tape. So yeah, we take things for granted nowadays with the internet and what we've got. But in them days, we had to present an overall picture that was well written. So yeah, Bricktight, I learned a lot as well, how to do a lot of the reports. But one of the things I did enjoy most of all was giving the presentations, because you met so many characters and so many people within the industry. It was amazing, especially from some of the manufacturers. I remember one of them that we did, they did cementitious grout anchors, and they had a salesman called Charlie Battle. And we were given a presentation in Grimsby in England, in the UK, that was a fishing community. So I told my mate Charlie Battle, Charlie, to dress accordingly. So he did. He come across and he had a big fish on his tie all the way down. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "It was a fishing community." I said, "Oh, Charlie." Anyway, he was a great guy. But the fact is that with Charlie, he had great knowledge and he'd traveled a lot, and he was the rep for the Syntex. And he certainly taught me a lot about the anchors and things like this. I was luckily enough to be involved in an organization where I learned a trade that was very specialized. Little did I ever think I'd end up in America, but that's a whole other story which we'll build up to. So, one of the things that I really did like was the importance of training. If anything, now I take away, that I'm so lucky to have had one-on-one training with Brian for many, many years, was that we learned how to work with all the systems for cavity wall tie replacement, cementitious grout anchors, specialized work. We got to work with each and every one of them and work with their reps and ask them the pros and the cons of the ties. And we learned the pros and the cons. We learned so many different things from that because we worked with Hilti, Helifix, Ancon, Syntec Haag. And one of the things is even with the Syntec Haag, you had to learn how to become a really good diamond core. So you had to learn how to do diamond cores into buildings so that you could insert the anchors into the buildings and inflate them and hold the building together. Pretty cool stuff, especially it keeps you on your toes. And even that, to learn how to do the anchors and the coring, it was all a learning curve. It was all training. But once you got into it, you wanted more. You really, really definitely wanted more. And another thing that I learned early on was one of the things is that in construction, it's bad enough as it is. Most times when we're working on dilapidated buildings, you have to appreciate that these are dangerous situations that we're going in to try and fix, and even trying to get an appraisal sometimes. So one of the things that Brian was always adamant, and to this day I thank him for it, was that he'd give us regular safety seminars on how to set up scaffolding, how to work your equipment, how to lay out your tools so that nobody gets hurt. If we've got a doorway, an opening, make sure that the access for public was covered. Make sure that your men was covered. So everything that we needed was certainly directed towards health and safety. So when I came to America, I've seen certainly a lot of sites that are lacking in a lot of ways, but I must admit, safety, it's important. It's hard enough to go to work every day in a dangerous environment, but you want to know that you're safe while you're doing it. And I think that that's one thing that I'd take away. And if I was going to teach more in the future, I would certainly say that that's a high priority. Is safety for anybody looking to get into this game. Now, one of the things is, I know I've been talking away here a lot, but one thing I would like to say that is that if anybody really, really wants to look at getting into installing wall ties and anchors and everything, you have to do your homework. And one of the things is I was lucky, I was trained highly by a lot of manufacturers who could invest a lot of money. Manufacturers are not investing a lot of money into repairing structures over here. So there's certainly not a lot of training in America. I think that if there was some training over here, I would definitely look towards Europe and especially England, because they've had a model, a training model since the 80s. The 80s, it started late 80s. And then one of the things where England was certainly way ahead of most countries, we were lucky because what we had what we called the Bible. I called it the Bible. And the Bible was the Building Research Establishment 329 Digest from the Building Research Establishment in England. When it was ran by the government, it did get bought out and went privatized. But what it did was that the Building Research Establishment Digest 329 certainly opened up a lot of how to investigate the building, what to look for, what to do when you found it, the reasons why wall ties corrode. Directions on appraisal, installation, thought techniques. It even had diagrams in there. It had all kinds of appendages that can tell you which directions you wanted to go. It certainly was a technical digest, but if you learnt it and I'm sure that a lot more people will be absorbing information like that in the future, because we need to digest as much information as we can so that in America, a standard operational procedure can come around. Now, I know that in America, we had, well, in England, we had codes. So we adapted for this. We changed our wall ties to be stainless steel. We improved on the galvanization so that the wall ties wouldn't corrode. We've adapted, but America's still not got to that level yet. It is changing. Codes are coming and buildings will be inspected and there will be appraisal. And I think that one thing in the old days, we only had old tech. So we had a metal detector, a flashlight, a mirror to be able to look into a 2-inch cavity, because that was in England. That was standard. A 2-inch cavity in the between the wall for the wall to breathe was standard, which was good for us because when we inserted an endoscope, we could see if the tie was connected or not connected or corroded. And also towards a little bit later, then we was able to attach a camera. So now we had a digital camera with an endoscope, which for training purposes is like putting a periscope in a wall so that you can look up and see underneath the tie and see if it's connected or not, and take a picture. That would be classed as non-destructive. Destructive testing would be where same said tie corroded, we take a brick out to observe the tie in situ as it is. So basically, you're removing it so that you can see the tie to determine corrosion, whether the tie is still okay, and make an assessment. Will it last longer, or should we isolate or treat it and then apply a new wall tie system to stabilize that wall? Is it technical? Can be, but it's great when you learn it, because you think of all the buildings out there that do need it. And we certainly need a lot more people that are going to be in this in the future. Myself, living in America, I see it day in, day out. So I know that things are certainly going to change. I think that one of the things after 35 years, I think that Brian Hindle and his father's legacy is a great model for anyone wanting to get involved in masonry restoration and stabilization. I mean, they certainly, Brian is just one of the top market leaders and made such a difference in the UK. Been involved in the Wall Tie Installers Federation, and that's going to be another story down the line. In England, we took it so serious, they had a Wall Tie Installers Federation to make sure that the actual wall ties were installed correctly, so that the procedures for installing wall ties were carried out. They even issued a 25 years insurance back guarantee. And what they did was, the founders of that, and I know Brian was on the leading edge of it, was to educate and show people it can be done and why it should be done and how it should be done. Because one thing that I am worried about over here in America, that if this takes off in America with the wall ties, there's going to be lots of people out there who are saying, all of a sudden, I'm an expert. No, you're not. But I think that ahead of it, if we can beat it to the draw and start thinking across the board that we will need education in this. And I think that a lot of the other industries in America are certainly sitting up and looking at it now and thinking, maybe we should be looking at this more. I hope they are, because if they are, someone might as well say, well, look, we do need training. We do need to think about this. And I think that masonry restoration is going to be a new industry. And I think that the people, yeah, go on. What was you going to say, Jo?
I'm just going to say, let's hope so, because there are so many gorgeous buildings, particularly around where you are in Texas, that are just falling down because they haven't been restored, they haven't been maintained, and they haven't been renovated in a thorough way. They've just kind of been botched back together again, and then they fall down again.
I think that one of the things that we learn, and especially you, you're English, same as me. Well, we're American now. But one of the things that we learn in England is we can't tear everything down and rebuild it because we don't have the space. And where you're going to dislocate people if you're going to do all this. So what we've had to do is we've had to learn to retrofit buildings cost effectively and efficiently using modern day techniques. Because I think an old friend of mine, Jamie Crowley, yeah, Jamie Crowley, he said to me once, the best carbon footprint is the one that's already there.
Absolutely,
And
yeah.
I think I'm totally in agreement with that as well, because the more buildings that we can maintain and stabilize, the better. Now, we know that in America, things are changing because we've seen the codes change in Seattle. They call it seismic retrofit, by the way. So now it makes me chuckle because if we're not in somewhere that's not a seismic retro place, is it now just retrofit?
It could well be.
I know. This is it. These are the things that keep me awake at night. But the thing is the joking aside, all buildings are going to need to be investigated. All buildings are going to be looked at. Can we save it? But it has to be done by someone that knows what they're doing. Because too many times I see people appraising buildings who have no skill set, no right. And the main thing is they don't know what's behind that wall. It takes a specialist to be able to open it up, an engineer, an architect with foresight to say, let's have a look at the guts. It's like an old car. When you get in there, it might be a bit rusty on the outside, but the engine might be great. Make your assessment. But the thing is that buildings are not being assessed for long-term worthiness because the thing is that you knock it down and try and rebuild it. I mean, even me, if you asked me if you wanted to knock an old historic building down, I'd say, why can't we just save all the bricks?
It makes sense.
There's plenty of them. Why fill up a landfill when you can take the bricks apart? When you think about it, after the war in Germany, when it was bombed and absolutely bombed to heck, what they did after the war was they started cleaning up and stockpiling bricks that were already there for future reuse. And they did. So it shows it can be done.
And the buildings look a lot like they did before the war, which is quite amazing. Some of
Well,
the buildings, anyway.
that's why I like working with buildings because they're fascinating. You never know what's going to be on the inside. You never know what's going to be there. So when you do, you've got to really think about it. So every job's different, every job's challenging. You never know just which way you're going to go. Yeah, it's a job where that I think that a lot of people would get a lot of satisfaction. And I think that older bricklayers who have had experience out in the field can adapt to how these buildings are constructed and can adapt and change. A young guy's approach to it is that he hasn't had the field experience. And I think that one thing with masonry restoration is that we're certainly going to need all the experience we can because a lot of the old vanguard are certainly dwindling away. So the skill sets are dwindling away. And I think that's one of the main points that I'm trying to make with this podcast is that we have to maintain the knowledge and share it before it's lost.
Well, thank goodness there's people like you out there who know what you're talking about and are willing to share it with other people.
Yeah, that's why I like the idea of us doing the magazine that we're doing. Because one of the things is that we sat and we talked, me and you, and we've certainly gone over a lot of things and said, hey, what's needed for the future? And one of the things I love about talking with you was you said, hey, Alan, tell me how you got into this. What did you do? What's your insight? What's the future? And things like this. So I sat and I sat and I talked with Jill here and I said, well, why don't we do a podcast? It's never been done on masonry restoration. And that if we can get people in to work and look at the things we're doing, because we have got a lot of experience and share that knowledge can be spread right across the board and worked upon, because as it's worked upon, it creates a good solid platform. And if anything I've learned is that certainly in most industries, you do need a standard operational procedure. And at the moment in America, with masonry restoration, wall tie and anchoring, there's no standard operational procedure and it won't come for a while. But one thing that me and Jill said was that if we could do it on a podcast and ask other people to come and talk to us, then we'd be able to share that knowledge. So this is what we're doing, and this is where the story starts with Brian Hindle and how and why I got here. Because I don't just repair little cracks in buildings. You have to assess the building, you have to feel it. Once you get into it, it's interesting working with other professionals in the field and sharing their knowledge and backwards and forwards to you. One thing that we did do was that me and Jill certainly wasn't happy enough with deciding a podcast would be good. What we've done is I've taken Gillian's great skill set, which is assisting me in coming up with a great idea to make a magazine. So what we've done is me and Jill sat together and we decided to do a magazine called Masonry Restoration Magazine.com. And we
Complete
started.
URL. Yes, the magazine is Masonry Restoration Magazine.
That's it, Masonry Restoration Magazine. You can tell it's so new, even I'm having problems with it. But it's a new concept, it's a great idea, and we're certainly opening up with some good articles. So one thing that I am hoping is that you get a chance to read it because we're going to release it quarterly and we're going to cover lots of different topics. Initially, me and Jill just wanted to put our thoughts down and let you think and see what you think of where we're going. Add and hopefully give us some feedback for the future articles. And we'll see how it goes from there. I think that the future for me in America is certainly I want to train people in what I do. I wouldn't like to think that I'm 64 now. I really wouldn't like to get to the point where I thought, man, I could have made a difference by teaching. So I think that what I'd like to do is look at training Hispanic communities in masonry restoration and get some grants and see if I can do that. And that I think is certainly going to help the industry move forward because it is going to need manpower. It is needs are going to be trained. And I think that foresight is certainly here. So if we can look at that and get involved in that, that would be good because at the same time, you're not only training to help a new trade, but what you are doing is you're making buildings safe and then people, the public, can feel a lot safer. So that's what I want to do, and that's what I am doing. And as I said, I really am glad that I got a chance to talk about one of my best mentors that I had in the market, and that is Brian Indle and his father. His father passed away. He was an honourable gentleman, but Brian's still around. I think that he's standing down now. He's getting a bit older, but he certainly set an example, and I hope to keep it going a little bit more in America. So that's where I'm at, Jill. What do you think?
Thank you so much for telling us about him. He sounds like a wonderful person. Well, the whole family sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for telling us about that. And let's see what we can do to get this training going.
All right. Well, that's me. And this
And
is.
that Do you have anything else to say? No, you're done. Okay. Well, catch us next time on Brick Talk Live. Bye.
Thank you for joining us this week for Brick Talk Live. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes, or just tell a friend about it. You can learn more about Alan Pettingale at alanpettingale.com and the podcast at bricktalk.live. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode.